Hello and welcome to another episode of our podcast, Marquette in Milwaukee. In this podcast, we'll explore the connections between Marquette University and the city it calls home, Milwaukee. I'm your moderator, Chris Jenkins, and our host is the 24th president of Marquette University, Mike Lovell. Our guests for this episode of Marquette in Milwaukee are Martha Berry, Racial Justice Director, YWCA Southeast Wisconsin, Dan Myers, the Provost at Marquette University, Joya Creer, Marquette's Assistant Vice President for Student Affairs, and William Welburn, the Executive Director of Marquette's Office of Institutional Diversity and Inclusion. Mike, the topic for today's discussion is fighting racism and creating a welcome environment for all. That's obviously a very broad topic, so let's start with a very specific step we're taking at Marquette. We've recently made the decision to partner with the YWCA and the Unlearning Racism Program, which will be offered to all of Marquette's leadership this year. Why'd you make that decision, and why now?
Well, first, I think we need to go back a couple of years when I read Father Brian Maskell's book, Racial Justice in the Catholic Church. And one of the chapters in there, he makes a very compelling argument that if you are not trying to change the current system, which our country operates in, which is unfair to certain populations of people, then you are inherently racist. And so it got me thinking, particularly with the most recent racial bias incident that happened last spring that was pretty tragic for the campus, that we all need to be thinking about how we should be fighting racism. And so one of the things that we brought to the campus leadership, the University Leadership Council, this year, we're going to do Unlearning Racism. And we're very excited. It's going to – obviously, it's something that it's not going to necessarily be easy for all of us. But I'm very excited that we're taking this step as a leadership team to really think about how we can create an environment on our campus where everyone feels supported, everyone feels welcome, and try to level the playing field.
Martha, you've worked with students at Marquette and faculty and staff in the past. What have you seen from that experience, and what do you hope that Marquette's leadership will gain from this program?
I think it's a combination of things. I think what we've seen from some of the folks that have gone through some of our programs is that they have a deeper understanding of the impact of racism, and particularly the roots. And the roots of racism is the hardest part to look at because our nation was so complicit in the structures of racism. And most of us didn't get a good understanding in our history lessons or from our families. Well, I take that back. Some families got a lot of information, and most of us who identify as white did not. So there's a compelling argument to be made that it's not just the interpersonal racism that we need people to understand, but the really systemic ways in which our government has been complicit. Redlining is a perfect example of that, and our community in Milwaukee has faced that and, you know, continues to face it, the subprime mortgage crisis in 2008 deeply impacted communities of color where people were given an understanding they were buying a house, you know, that was going to be an opportunity to really settle down and stabilize families. And the rates kept going up and people were quickly in dire circumstances. So there's a systemic way that we need to be able to look at racism and not just the interpersonal things that happen and create the crises of the moment. There's a deep challenge to us as a nation, I think, to look at the deeper reasons for why we've gotten to where we are.
So for people who are not familiar with this program, how would you describe it?
So we describe it as it's an opportunity for us to dig in. The first three sessions are heavy with content information. So we start by looking at the impact, defining terms. We move into the roots, looking at Milwaukee's racism as contrasted to what was happening nationally, and then get into how it manifests. And we use housing because that's such a classic example. So it's a building block of information, which then gets us to the point where we can look at, well, what does it mean to address racism? How do we as a community go about interrupting those racist incidents as they're happening, but also look at those structural policies and practices that need further examination, may have been created for really good reasons, but don't hold water anymore and need to be examined, need to see that the disparate impacts are really deeply impacting communities of color in ways that probably were not intended. And then what can we do about it? So the last session is really, what's my next step? What do I need to investigate? What do I need to learn further? What do I need to do? Because I think there's a place where we all need to hold ourselves accountable. Some of us are on the side of, you know, on any oppressive system. There's those of us who are targeted by it and those of us who are the oppressors. And there's much that we need to do in collaboration with each other. But if we don't know what our role is, we're not going to be successful.
If there's other businesses or institutions interested in this program, how do they get involved?
Yeah, so they we do the course as a community. So we have 50-some people signed up for this fall's course, so it's full. But we're also offering it in Racine. So we offer it now 3 times a year so that we get more people through it. But then we've also had people that have come through the course and have said, you know, our organization really needs this. And so we've adapted the course and made it possible for folks at the medical college, for example, to go through something that really focuses on medical racism and the histories of health inequities, et cetera. So it really depends on the organization in terms of what their needs are. We can tailor it. And then we've also tailored shorter sessions and getting at implicit bias and the ways in which race shows up in those situations.
The rest of our panel, why is this sort of programming valuable to Marquette or really any institution of higher education?
I mean, I think part of what Martha's program can do for us in terms of leadership jumping in is that thinking about it from a systemic perspective as well as an institutional level. Oftentimes, institutions will kind of work with students primarily because students are have the loudest voice. However, when we think about the structure in place and as well as those who are in decision-making opportunities, it's really leadership. And so having leadership partner with students and kind of doing their own work in terms of challenging the status quo around racism and other forms of oppression really is a step forward for not just Marquette, but I think higher education in general. And so to have our leadership take that step forward really says a lot about our determinism to, you know, really challenge racism.
William, your thoughts on this?
I agree. I think that structural racism is really something that is damaging so many organizations today. And I think we in higher education have a real responsibility here to address this in within our organizations because our purpose is to lead in knowledge creation and in education and learning. So to be able to do that and do that effectively, we need to address this issue within our own institution, within our own organization, among the people who work within our organization. And so this is a real opportunity for us.
Dan, your perspective?
Yeah, I often think that we get very focused on specific instances of individual acts of racism, and that's important for us to address. And, you know, we try to be as aggressive as we can be in dealing with those kinds of situations on our campus. But there's so much more, and I think that's part of what everyone is saying here, is that we need to understand the structures and the systems that are behind racism and the outcomes for different kinds of people. And higher education institutions really have a responsibility and a commitment to try to correct some of these inequities that have developed over long periods of time. And it's a real challenge to do that. We have to be really intentional in understanding what's around us, but ourselves as well, if we're going to do that. So I agree with Joya that it's so great that the leadership of this university is going to step up and really step in to this in a really public, open way and demonstrate to our campus our commitment to moving ahead and to doing things differently.
Yeah, for our Marquette representatives on the panel, and Martha, feel free to share your perspective as well. Marquette, like other college campuses, has experienced painful incidents with racial tension on campus. And as Mike mentioned, this included a high-profile incident this past spring when a student of color received an airdropped racially charged image. What happens in the wake of incidents like this? And how do we go about healing and creating a welcoming environment for everybody?
Well, I think when you have incidents like this, it's a lightning rod. And all the hurt that people have been feeling for years can somehow come to the surface. And so for all of us in the that were in the room the day after that happened, and we're with several hundred students of colors, we realized how emotional this was for them and how they wanted, they're looking to us as leaders to start changing things so that they felt more welcome and things like this didn't happen. And again, this was something that, you know, you can imagine the young woman this happened to. You know, she gets this picture, she doesn't know who sent it, whether she's in immediate danger or not, and whether she should get out of the place where she is. And so, again, it's a traumatic experience. And so we have to realize that when these things happen, there's first the direct impact of the individuals, but also others have experienced similar things. It's a trigger for them.
Mm-hmm. When these kinds of things happen, too, there's the incident itself. But when people experience it and observe it, it brings back a lot of other experiences that they've had. And so, and that's what we heard in the forum with students, wasn't, they weren't just worried about that particular incident, but they were, you know, talking about all kinds of other things that had built up in their experience, in their lives, and at Marquette, in Milwaukee. And it really, so it's a bigger issue than any one particular instance. And it's really important for a university or any organization to take the opportunity at those moments to stand up and trumpet what our values really are. That's one thing that those moments really call for, is for us to, you know, reaffirm that to our whole community.
Joya, obviously you work with students every day as part of your role at Marquette. What are you hearing? What did you hear from them then, and what are you hearing from them now?
Good question. In the moment, I think what we heard was questions. What are we going to do as an institution? How are we going to be responsive? And I think what we tried to do was be responsive to the direct student who was impacted by that incident, but also be willing to have an open dialogue where, as leadership, we listen. I think we wanted to share a lot of information, but what became clear during that forum that evening was that students had a lot to say, both on the graduate and undergraduate level, and it was our responsibility to sit there and actually listen, to take in, to process what they were suggesting, what they were reporting, the questions they had for us, as well as the challenges that they put forward to us. While it was a challenging evening, it also opened up a dialogue that has continued since then. We have new students in leadership. As you know, every year we have new students, voices that come to the table who really have asked us over the summer to continually have conversation about some of the petitions they put forward and suggestions. They've asked us what has moved forward. We have willingly shared that. One of the demands that they had was around transparency. And so we've really tried to maintain and create consistent ways where we can keep them in the dialogue, as well as receive, you know, their feedback and their assessment of how well it's working. I mean, the system is only as well as those who are part of it can see it working. And so it really meant that we had to open up some new doors and windows so that they could see some of the inner workings and the efforts that we were making. And I anticipate that that will continue throughout the year, whether there's an incident or not, that we will all, you know, collectively and collaboratively continue to work on our campus climate.
William, what was your perspective on that incident and sort of everything that's developed since then?
Well, I think I go back to our some of the results of our 2015 climate study, where in climate studies of organizations essentially accomplish two things. They identify things that people have experienced and things that people have observed. What I think was interesting about our climate study was that certainly we found that one in five people on our campus experienced things that made them uncomfortable, not wanted on campus, harassment, other kinds of things. But one-third of the people who responded to the survey, that's about 1,000 people, observed behaviors on campus. So when I think about this particular incident, I think it is a part, I look at it in that context, in a broader context of the everyday experiences of our students, of our staff, of our faculty, and how we take the observations that we have of these things and act upon them, begin to change the institution.
Martha, unfortunately, we're not unique in this respect, and this could happen pretty much anywhere in our society. What do institutions need to know about this sort of thing and how to respond to it?
I think there's a couple of things that institutions need to be aware of. One, they are expecting the leadership to step into the situation and not back away. They want to see people, as Joy said, very transparently, visibly taking an action on it. And, you know, you may stumble, you may say things wrong, and you need to clean that up in terms of moving into it. But I think there's a way that stepping back in any way in those moments sends a message to people that it's not safe to talk about an incident or bring it forward. So I think it really is the boldness of leadership that can step into it instead of stepping away. And I had the opportunity, students wanted to have another forum after the first forum, and so I was able to facilitate that. And what I witnessed was students really sharing their hearts, you know, and giving them space to just talk to each other. We did listening pairs, or we had the opportunity to just listen to one other person and then talk at tables. And many of them, like William said, in terms of the climate survey, they observe all kinds of things going on. They're not stupid. They're really engaged. And many of the ones that I saw wanted to be a part of the solution. They didn't want to have the institution fail. They want it to succeed. And I think that's true in most situations, but I think there's a place where we come at it in very different ways. And I think it's hard for us who identify as white to understand what it's like to navigate as a person of color in an institution that is largely not, they're not represented. So they're not seeing themselves in higher leadership. They're not seeing themselves necessarily in professors. Even on their dorm floors, they're not. And so they navigate in ways that we can't even anticipate what that's like. And so I think every institution has to be ready to be much more nimble in how they respond, and not by backing away, we're giving permission to say, my silence is the best I can figure out right now, which is a complicit response and is a cowardly response in terms of being in that moment. We have to be braver, knowing that we may screw it up, but we have to at least attempt. Because in attempting, we're going to learn, okay, well, that didn't work. I got to try something different the next time. And I think every institution has to figure that out for themselves. And you can see it because there's been so many different incidences of airplane, you know, people getting kicked off, dragged off, whatever. You know, how that institution responds says a lot to people's confidence in, I trust that institution, I will follow them.
Yeah, for everybody here on the panel who was here that night of the forum, what did you hear? What stood out from the messages that students delivered? Because a lot of people, there's certainly understandably some anger, but a lot of people put a lot of thought into their messages. They were reading from their phones. They put thought into what they wanted to say to all of you as leaders. What did you hear that night?
So for me, it actually goes back even earlier in that evening when we viewed the movie. It was I to Marquette. And where, you know, it was an excellent film that's documented how, you know, some of our students of color experience our university. And it was much different than certainly I experienced university, and hearing how isolated and alone they feel when they go into classes and they're the only person of their color or in there, and how hard that is for them. And made me realize that as an institution, we need to do a better job of making everyone feel supported and welcome, because there are students on our campus that just don't feel supported in any way. And again, it's very hard for them to navigate a world where, you know, just the other night we had dinner for the Aspen Center, and the speaker happened to be sitting at my table, and he came from a high school in you know, North Milwaukee. And he said there was only two white people in his whole school, and he came to Marquette campus, and he was the minority, and he was the only black person in many of his classes. And you know, he said it was really hard for him to figure out how to live in this world. And so it made me realize he's not the only one. We heard from the other students. There's a lot of students like that. So how can we do a better job of making those students feel like they're an integral part of our university, not isolated in somewhere else outside?
Yeah, I should mention that I believe we're screening that film on campus next week, too, and it was an excellent film. Joya, what were some of your takeaways either from the film screening or that night?
I think from that evening, what I observed was a lot of passion, a lot of hurt and pain from our students, and that in that evening they wanted to make sure that their voice was heard, and that at times they had felt that they weren't being heard, maybe individually, maybe, you know, in a classroom, but really felt, I think, empowered with the number of students that were there and the number of leaders who sat on that stage that night, that this was a forum where they could actually have kind of a group backing and have the attention of the leadership of the institution. I think what we also heard was that it wasn't just about this incident. I think we've kind of alluded to that, that there was a context at Marquette at that time that for some students, it wasn't surprising that this incident happened, that this was an example of perhaps some of the other experiences that they had had on our campus with each other as students, with administrators in the classroom. And so in some ways, I think that's the hurt that we kept, you know, hearing around re-traumatization for some of our students. And we also heard the hope that if we did listen as leadership, that we were actually going to take action in the hope that that action would result in some kind of change. I think our students wanted the change to happen immediately. And we know when it comes to systemic change that that is not necessarily something that we can promise. But what we could promise is that we would stay engaged in the conversation. And so I think it was a small step forward, but I think being able to actually have them view us listening, taking notes, and following up with many of them post really has kind of paved the way for where we are this fall.
William, what were some of your takeaways?
I agree with Joya. I think being heard was part of the lesson from that evening. I think also where I fall short in responding to the practice of everyday racism that students experience on campus, and how I and we can respond to those things. What can we do in our environment? They were offering the door, an open door for us to begin to think very, very clearly about how we're going to proceed with that. And so for me, It was an incredible experience to sit there with the students, listening to them, allowing their anger to express things that have been building up for years on campus. So it was an important experience.
Dan, your perspective?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things has already been said a couple times, really, is that They wanted to be heard more. I mean, that was a big issue. But there was the other side of the communication part, too, and they weren't hearing enough from us. And so I think both of those are important. In fact, a couple of things that they wanted us to do were things that we've already started doing, but they didn't know that. And they weren't able to take advantage of those resources and those support systems because they didn't know. And so I think that's a big challenge for us, too, is to connect people up to us and to resources in ways that are going to be helpful to them and not just have them be things that we have, but they're actually things that we have that are making a difference because they're connecting with students. And so I took that away from that forum as a real important challenge for us to address.
Yeah, I want to, that was the second point I think I'd like to make. One of the takeaways I had is I feel like I communicate all the time. And it's very clear that whatever communications I had or whatever means I'm doing it and whatever platforms I'm using was not reaching these students. And it was interesting because I heard very clearly that they don't know who I am. They don't see me at their events. But likewise, on the flip side, they don't invite me to their events. And so I have to be very proactive in finding ways to connect with these students. And I will say one of the things I'm most excited about this year already, they're inviting me to their things, which I think is a big step forward. And, I try to go to any student group and vice versa, but I think it's important that they know that, that I want to be accessible. I want them to know who I am. I want to be their president. And so it was clear that there was a definite disconnect, and I would say it was both ways. I wasn't being proactive enough to find out what events they were having and how I could connect with them, and they weren't actually reaching out to me either.
I just wanted to add one more thing. We had the good fortune the other evening of celebrating the accomplishments of Father O'Brien and the Les Aspin Center. One of the things I just wanted to point out about that, he has over 30 years trained an incredibly diverse group of Marquette students who have gone on to do pretty amazing things. And I recall one of the things he said in his comments had to do with the problem of clutter, that there's so much clutter that gets in the way of students' aspirations of where they want to go in life. And I think that was one of the things that we saw that evening. They were putting the clutter right out there on the floor for us to see and really seeking a response from us, because those are the things that happen in the classroom, things that happen in the residence hall and elsewhere on campus are impeding their progress to achieve the goals that they want to achieve.
Martha, it seemed like that struck a chord with you right there.
Well, I think there's a way that we need to stand in those joyful moments and those painful moments. And sometimes it's just being able to listen. And we, as Joya said, I think earlier, it's not going to turn around overnight. We're not going to be able to have instant solutions. But being able to be in those moments, as President Lovell, as you've shared, they're inviting you and you're, you know, you think you're communicating all the time, but they're not hearing it, or it's not getting to them in the ways that you thought it was getting to them. I think any institution, you know, you've got so much on your plate when you're at the top of the organization. There's so much that you're trying to handle and manage, and that it is not important to them. You know, it's important to the running of the institution, but at the same time, they want to see the human that's out there standing with them in those moments that are painful, joyful, exciting, horrifying. Because I think there's a way that we forget we're in it together, because it can feel like they've lost touch with us. They're the status quo. They're keeping things in place. And, you know, back to what William's saying, I think there's a way that we can all do better. And it's hard. It's hard to stand in those moments when it's really painful. And we have to, you know, steel ourselves in a particular way to be in those moments that are really hard. But, you know, how many of us have been to funerals where it's painful and there's nothing else you can say and all you can do is stand there? Sometimes I think that the presence of us being in some of those situations can state more than any words we can share, you know, that we're willing to stand in those spots. So,
Dan, what progress are we making in terms of faculty hiring and student recruitment?
Well, we've done well with student recruiting in the last few years. The fall class that came in last year was the highest, the most diverse class that we've ever had at Marquette, actually, and we were close to that again this year. We have some very aggressive goals in our strategic plan to grow diversity in our student population, and I think we've built a lot of support systems around that, and we're continuing to build them. We have to attend not just to getting people to campus, but taking care of them once they're here and making sure that people have the right resources they need to be successful at Marquette. And on the faculty side, it's slower going. I mean, obviously, we replace our entire student population every 4 years, but the faculty, it takes longer. But we've done a few things to try to move that forward. Last year, we did a cluster hire in support of our race and ethnic studies program, and we hired 6 people. And that was a really terrific moment for us. And it helped us not just with those particular searches, but I think it sent a message out to higher education that we're serious about what we're doing. And it really helped us with some of our other pools for other positions as well, beyond those in the cluster. And we're going to do the cluster again this year. We have 9 positions that we're going to try to fill this year, and maybe 10. Still working on trying to fit one more in there. And again, I think that'll be a really big message to the industry that Marquette is really serious and trying to do something really substantial. It's not just about the numbers and the representation, though. It's about how those faculty members can really help us change our climate too. And it really enlivens all of our dialogue about race and ethnicity and lots of different kinds of social justice issues on campus when we diversify our faculty population in lots of different ways. And so we're very happy with the progress we're making, and we have some really aggressive goals to continue doing that.
But always more work to do, right?
There's always more work to do, and one thing we always have to remember is that we have to continue to be ready to stand in these moments, because they're not going to go away until the entire society around us changes. I've been working in this field for 30 years now, and some of the incidents and things that happen on our campus were happening 30 years ago, and people were tired of them then. And so it's, every year we get another at Marquette, we get another 2,000 students and that haven't been in this environment before. And that's not for us to be satisfied in any way or slow us down. It's to say we got to steel ourselves for the next round of this, because we've got another group of students that we need to work with, and we want to be a place that's different from the rest of society, that's better. And so that's what we're trying to work toward.
William, how do you see our hiring practices changing?
I think we have much more enthusiasm among faculty in trying to figure out how to hire for diversity or to engage in inclusive hiring practices. When I first got here, I think people were interested, But now, not only are they interested, but they actually believe that they can do this. Happens department by department, search committee by search committee. And so when I meet with hiring committees or search committees, I think the major takeaway is to be more intentional about what you're doing. And also challenging them to do something that the religious studies scholar Eddie Glaub Jr. encourages us to do, which is to change our habits about the way we do things, because that's what the world around us really desperately needs. So every faculty member that we hire is a faculty member who will be here for decades to come. And as our changing, as the demographics of our student population changes, they need to be ready and open to meeting the challenges of an engaged classroom.
Mike, in the wake of last year's incident, you shared a message on social media to campus that stated, quote, "We shouldn't expect only students of color to respond to racism. I'm asking all of Marquette to join me and share why you stand against racism." And you added, quote, "Privilege means using your position to speak up and bring about change." Why was sharing that message important to you?
Well, first, you know, I think as a white male, you know, obviously I've had a much easier path of success than many other parts of our population. And I feel I have a responsibility with that privilege to make change, you know, so that it's a level playing field for everyone. And to really, you know, when I see injustice, to act on making it different. And so I just wanted the campus to know that certainly the incident that happened, you know, wasn't acceptable. But in general, the way students were experiencing our campus that maybe didn't come from the same background I did, you know, we needed to change. We do need to change and improve, and it should never stop. I mean, the climate study gave us a baseline. We should always be continuously trying to improve from that baseline.
And the burden shouldn't be on people of color. It should be on...
No, actually, it should be on everyone in the whole campus working together to make the change and, you know, working hand-in-hand with those who are oppressed, you know, as well, and to understand, listen and understand what they're experiencing, because that's the only way we can bring about change.
For people who are listening to this podcast, how can people who are listening right now take action?
I think one of the ways in which people can take action is when you see something, when you observe something, to interrupt. I have a colleague who uses the metaphor of just jump in front of the train just to stop it. You may not have the right tools. You may not have the right wording. You may not have an intervention in your head. But if you can stop or slow down that train, you've interrupted its path so that other people can come in and be advocates. You know, you might have something that you would like to share. But I think it's important that people don't necessarily just let something kind of pass by and say, well, I wish I had or I could have. I think the other thing is to be vigilant. Oftentimes, I think we hear things and we don't necessarily process it in the moment because we are bombarded by things all day long, whether it's email, phone calls, etc. But we have to remain vigilant that just because this moment is a good moment doesn't mean that racism has gone away. Just because I haven't observed it in the last 5 minutes doesn't mean that systemically there aren't policies and practices that don't disproportionately affect minoritized populations. And so really maintaining that vigilance and that consistency, I think, is important.
William, what would you say people can do?
I think becoming aware is extremely important. My background, of course, is in library information science, so I'm going to suggest books. I'm going to suggest that you read things like Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson, or Brian Massengale's book, Racial Justice and the Catholic Church. Or a very, very popular book over in England right now, Reni Itelodge's book, Why I No Longer Talk to White People About Race. She's challenging people across Britain. It's being translated into Swedish and other languages, to think about all of the things in history and all the things across society that are happening and become aware of them and become engaged in these issues rather than rely on other people to educate you. Go through that process yourself.
Martha, what can people listening do?
Oh, I think there's so many things that we can do, but I want to just second many of what folks have said, and I think it is building our awareness and our knowledge. I think many of us were deprived of good information and good knowledge, so books can be a way. But I think we also sometimes have to get into spaces where we're going to be uncomfortable, which means that I have to go eat in restaurants that I might say, that people have told me, don't go there, don't go on that street, don't. And hang in spaces where we're not going to be the dominant group. We're going to be in a space where it might feel like, ooh, that, you know, that was kind of shocking. And then when people bring up things, social media is just out of control in some regards. But there are times where I've heard somebody say something, and I'm like, ooh, I got to think about how I've responded in the past. And therefore, so there, I think there's a lot of individual ways that we can act. But I think as an institution, there's a lot of things we get to think about in terms of, you know, are we doing enough in terms of the getting people on board into the campus? And what are we doing to support them? So what do those groups need to look like that are going to help navigate, like the young person from the high school on the north side that was used to being around all people that look like him, suddenly he's in this campus that's very predominantly white. How do we support him to feel like this is still his campus and he's should be welcomed, et cetera? So, you know, do we have accessibility in many fronts? You know, what are we doing in terms of scholarships? What are we doing to support the faculty and the staff who are often where the students will go to? Like, if I feel like Joya can listen to me here, I'm going to Joya's office, you know? So then it's not just Joya listening. How do we support Joya in that? You know, how do we support Dan? How do we support anybody in the institution who's sort of doing that heavy lift again and again? Institutionally, what would that look like to put together something in terms of ways of supporting and making things happen? And, you know, curriculum, too often, I think teachers get into ruts in terms of, but this is the way I've always taught it, or this is the best that needs to be shared, and aren't willing to step outside their comfort zones and have those hard conversations in the classes when the young people bring things up. Things are on their mind, and you need to give them space to be able to talk about those things. I taught a class over at UW-Milwaukee on exploring institutional racism, and it was for students that were going to be school social workers. And they'd get mad that the teachers didn't have to go through a similar class, because there's a lot of diversity classes that are offered, but are they enough? Are they actually having the conversations about race and racism where they're going to be uncomfortable, and we're still going to say, so what did you see in the news, and what did you hear? You know, what incident are you aware of that's happened, and how do we talk about that and get all of us much more comfortable having those conversations? I don't have all the answers, and trust me, I've blown it more than two handfuls many times, and still keep going back, because you're going to learn again that there's something else that can be done. So on the institutional level, I think there's many things we can do.
Dan, what can people do?
Yeah, so I'm taken by much of what people are saying here, and in particular, I really try to practice and say this to other people, and I'm parroting our director for community engagement, Dan Bergen at Marquette, who says that you need to, when you encounter tension, you need to lean into it, not away from it. And people are talking about different ways that we can do that. But I want to emphasize something else to people who are listening, who want to individually approach this. And, you know, the Jesuit way starts with self-awareness. And I think that we all need to really sit down and take a hard look at ourselves and have an honest conversation with ourselves about where we've come from in our lives and what kind of advantages that we might have had and different ways that we might have built up an implicit bias in some way, and really try to take that apart and understand that for ourselves and recognize that we've been advantaged as white people in ways that we can't even see. And that other people have, you know, given us things because we're white. And we didn't even know it. We just thought, you know, we were the best one or something. And we didn't know someone else was enacting racism on our behalf. And to really try to encounter some of those things for ourselves and realize how much they permeate the experience, even though it's not as in our face, because we're on the plus side of that. We're not on the downside. And it's easier to see when somebody's hurting you than when you're implicitly hurting others. And so understanding that social location that we have can help us have a much more honest engagement with all these other things that we want to do.
It's interesting, though, right? Because there's a lot of people in our society who would push back against what you just said. They'd say, I worked hard to get what I have. What would you say to people who don't believe that's an issue?
Well, I'd probably tell them some stories about how I used to think that about myself and how I came up from nothing. And then I discovered later on, through other sort of backdoor means, that people had actually purposely given me benefits because I was a white kid when I was growing up in various ways, in high school and college and so on. And I found out these direct things, and I never would have known that. And we have to realize, you know, that was an eye-opener for me because I hadn't seen all of those things. And then it started making me think about lots of different things in my life that could have been me being so great, which maybe I was thinking a little bit too much of myself, or that could have been something that was an unfair advantage that people gave to me. And that is, I think it's important to think about the possibilities there and not always think that everybody's a self-made person.
Mike, Dan mentioned the Catholic and Jesuit lens. How do you see this issue through the Catholic and Jesuit lens? And anybody else who wants to jump in?
I mean, social justice is a key element of the Catholic Church. And, you know, when I think about what we're all called to do from the Catholic-Jesuit lens is, you know, first, I think my wife Amy has a placard in our bathroom that says, life begins at the end of your comfort zone. And so we all need to be discomforted around the space. And I think part of that is, you know, changing the status quo. You know, I think that's one thing that the church won't call us to do, because right now the status quo is unfair to a lot of people in this world. And so, first of all, we've heard before, we need to educate ourselves first to understand what the status quo is. And then we need to think about ways we can lean into those difficult conversations and difficult topics that will bring about change. And so I really think that all of us, you know, that are at a Catholic Jesuit institution or just in society in general, need to be thinking about how we all can make the world better. And that really is, when you think about the mission of our universities, where men and women form with others, and we're called to make those changes in serving others.
We know we live in a city that has a significant share of racial tension and racial issues. How does that context, how do you view the context of Milwaukee and where Marquette stands within that context?
When you think about Jesuit education and Jesuit institutions, many of them, if not all, are located in urban areas intentionally, and intentionally in the sense of being part of the community and being part of the city. And Marquette is part of Milwaukee. And so while we're an institution, we don't have gates. You know, community members are more than welcome to be part of our community, and we would hope the same would be extended to us as being part of Marquette and Milwaukee. I think having the history of segregation in terms of housing, different neighborhoods, churches, and whatnot, is part of Marquette's history, too. And so when we have students and faculty and staff who come from Milwaukee, they bring that with them to campus. We also, I think, try to engage the city in those conversations. I think the city and Marquette, neither one of us are perfect. I think both of us are entities that are trying to move forward, but also realizing that the context is one in which we have to walk very lightly, given the history of trauma and oppression that still continually exists. You see it in media with people who are everyday people and, you know, our athletes, our city council people. And so we really need to think about how does that, the ground literally that we sit on, not just in Milwaukee racially, but also thinking about, you know, we also are sitting on Native American land as well. And that has come up from our students and from other areas of conversation around oppression. And so all of that, you know, makes this complicated, but nonetheless something that we need to, you know, lean in probably even more so if we really think about the context in which we are teaching and learning.
William, your thoughts on that?
Well, one might argue that Marquette is a product of a highly segregated community, of a highly segregated city. And I think it's something that we really need to think about. When you look at the demographic map of Milwaukee, it's very stark because you see that block there that is Marquette that is very different from its surroundings. We also have to remember that as Milwaukee is a highly segregated city, it's that's really a function of it being a very, very diverse city. We just haven't found ways to make diversity work well in Milwaukee, work toward our benefit. We could be a very, very exciting city if we could somehow turn segregation around and really focus on what makes us good, which is to have so many different populations here. Now, that's a challenge for Marquette as well, because if we lack the diversity, we could, through by becoming a more diverse community within the university, we could actually take a leadership role in working with our community beyond our campus.
Yeah, I want to pull on that a little bit because, again, we happen to be in one of the most segregated cities in the country, and that obviously is a challenge in many ways, but it's also an opportunity, right? It's an opportunity for our campus and the talents and the gifts that we have to make positive change and to train our students and have our faculty and staff be involved in making Milwaukee better. And, you know, I think there's nothing, you know, more that I'd be prouder of if Marquette was one of the driving forces that helped change our city for the better, particularly around racism and segregation.
And we have to remember that segregation isn't just about race. It's also about economics and finances and how people can live their lives. And I think a lot of Marquette's history, it hasn't felt to most of the population, the vast majority of the population of Milwaukee, like it was an accessible institution to them. And, you know, we have been working to change that. I know people have been working to change that before I came here even, but we've really tried to make Marquette be a part of the community in a different way and to make it more accessible to people from Milwaukee in different ways that can help us be a better representation of this city, but also be a bigger part of this city. And part of that is inviting people onto our campus and have that feel like their space too. And we've tried to do that in a number of different ways. I think we've made some progress on that with some of the events that we've had on campus. The Marquette Forum over the past couple of years, I think, has been a real moment when the community of Milwaukee and the community of Marquette have come together in a beautiful way. And so we're continuing to work on that, knowing that it's a big challenge and that there's more to it than just race, because Marquette is a private university that costs a lot of money to come to, and that's a challenge for people that's not surmountable.
Martha, your thoughts on the context of Marquette?
Oh, I think it's a deep one, Chris. And that's
a separate podcast.
Yeah,
right?
We could do a whole podcast on it, because I think there's ways that Milwaukee, you know, even just how many years ago, there were a lot of family sustaining wage jobs in manufacturing that allowed the city to be just a thriving place where folks wanted to move to. And wanted to make it their home, and then stayed, even though, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, so many of those, I think it was like close to 50,000 manufacturing jobs left. It just decimated whole neighborhoods. And by then, the white flight was already happening. So a lot of white families were not wanting to stay in the city, which left housing stock in really poor shape. And the transportation system is anemic. It's, you know, we're trying to figure some things out now. But there's so many complicit institutions that work together to make the city as harsh as it is. And I think people are quick to blame Milwaukee. You know, it's Milwaukee's fault that we're in the state that we're in. But there's so many good people trying to work on those issues. And I think more often than not, we need to hear from the people that are in those, you know, devastated, ravaged neighborhoods who have some really good ideas but can't get those ideas funded. And too many of the resources, you know, up and leave and go to the suburbs. And, you know, Milwaukee is no different than a lot of northern urban cities. But we haven't figured out how to talk to each other to, you know, there's divides, the interstate divides in big ways. You know, from Marquette, if you go down 16th Street, what happens on the other side of that, you know, bridge? And there's just ways that we're not good about finding common ground. You know, we're used to fighting and screaming and yelling to try to change things, which is important, and we probably need to do more of that to actually bring some of the issues out. But then how do we actually find some common ground to move forward? I think there's just a lot that the city and Marquette could definitely be a part of it in terms of driving that change and moving us in the right direction. Yeah, how do we do it together?
You know, I think about last year when I put out the President's Challenge was specifically to do that, you know, requiring, you know, our faculty and staff and students to go into the community and work with those communities to about the disparities that are within those communities and solve some of those problems, you know, utilizing resources from the campus, but also the ideas that are being generated by members within the community that knew the path forward and to make positive progress.
And you'll be hosting a conference on trauma this coming week. And I think a lot of those issues that Martha just mentioned are sort of the core tenets of the work that you and Amy and this big group of people are trying to address right now.
Yeah, and again, when you think about our city and many of its ills, they're rooted in trauma that have been over the past 30, 40 years they've experienced, if not even longer. Matter of fact, when I go, we host the swim meetings, I still hear about things going back to Bronzeville, about how I-43 decimated in a very important part of the African-American community here in Milwaukee. And so we have a lot, a lot of healing to do. But, again, if we can understand, what the root causes of some of the problems are and then have strategic ways to address that, from a community impact model, we'll start moving the needle a little bit.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Marquette in Milwaukee. More episodes of this and other Marquette podcasts can be found at marquette.edu/podcasts.